I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The videotape of barrels of explosives in Iraq that was shot by a Minneapolis television crew in April of 2003 has been viewed by former Weapons Inspector David Kaye, who says the explosives are consistent with those missing from the Al-Qaqa weapons facility. If true, the tape would seem to confirm that the weapons were looted from the base after the U.S. invasion rather than before it, as many U.S. officials are saying. But after being asked about the tape on NBC's Today show, Paul Bremer, former top U.S. administrator in Iraq, had this to say.
We simply don't know what the facts are. We don't know if more troops would have mattered. We don't know when the explosives left. I think it's quite plausible that they were gone before we even got there.
Well, on the line now, we have former KSTP reporter Dean Staley. He and his crew were embedded with the 101st Airborne in Iraq. He joins us on the line from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Dean.
Good to be here.
We're also joined by photographer Joe Caffrey, and he joins us from Minneapolis. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good afternoon.
And I know that you both were responsible for these images. Reporter Dean, let's ask you first. Are you sure that you were at that right facility and that those were the explosives that are now being debated on the campaign trail?
I'm not certain that we're talking about the exact same explosives that are in question here. I do believe that we were at Al-Qaqa at this facility. It was deserted. It was a massive facility based on GPS coordinates that I have that tell me exactly where we were camped.
That's a global positioning unit that you had.
Right. And I know from that point which direction and about how far we drove. Looking at all the evidence that's sort of out now, it's clear to me that we were somewhere at that facility. Now, whether the bunkers that we looked into are the same that the inspectors are talking about right now, I don't know that we have the definitive answer. But clearly we were at Al-Qaqa a week, 9 days after Baghdad fell.
Joe Caffrey, you were looking through the viewfinder at these explosives. How were people reacting to them? What did you see?
Well, when Dean and I were invited to tag along with two members of the 101st on this tour of this military camp, we were surprised, certainly, to see all the amounts of explosive material inside of these bunkers. And as we went from one bunker to the next, we were cautious not to touch any of the white powder. Some of the soldiers were handling some of the explosives. It's fair to say we were in awe of what we were seeing at the time.
Did you see things like seals from the Atomic Energy Commission? Did you see things that would illustrate that this was dangerous material?
We did. We noticed that there were seals, a small brown copper lead seal attached to a thin wire wrapped around some of these locks, and we were cautious to break those seals. We wanted to see what was inside. The military was very curious. We were all curious to see what was inside these bunkers, and now we're finding that these seals are matching up with the atomic energy seals.
Mm-hmm. And Dean, of course, the date is critical. Are you sure that you were there after the fall of Saddam Hussein?
Oh, there's no question. April 18th. I mean, Joey wrote it down on the tape the day we shot it. I have my notes. We spent a week camped at that place, and we weren't camped there until after Baghdad fell. And, in fact, those seals that Joey and you were both talking about, I thought they might be booby traps because they were these very thin wires, and there was no reason that I could see. I mean, they weren't big enough to keep anyone out of these bunkers, so I couldn't figure out exactly why someone would have put them there. Right. We now know that they were seals, likely from the Energy Commission.
And Dean, Joe was saying that people were in awe just seeing this huge amount of explosives. What were your thoughts about whether or not they were guarded? I mean, what did you see? Were there people there guard? What was it like?
The place was absolutely deserted. At one point, we saw a truck full of Iraqis driving around, and we were keeping an eye on them because we were literally in no man's land. I mean, we had gone outside of our base. We were at this massive facility that was abandoned, deserted, and we saw some Iraqis driving around in a truck, and so we were keeping an eye on them, concerned that they might attack us, that they might not be friendlies. And it turned out that they were probably scavenging from what we could tell. They were going looking for scrap metal or perhaps for weapons. We don't know. But it didn't. You have to remember the context. The context was that everyone was looking for weapons of mass destruction. So it didn't strike me as particularly odd that this place wasn't guarded, because my thinking was, well, if this place isn't guarded, the military must have already checked it out, and they must know that there isn't any WMD here. They must be looking at places where there's a higher probability that they will find weapons of mass destruction. So that was my own sort of rationale in my own mind at the time for why there weren't American soldiers stopping us from going into this place.
Right. And Dean, your thoughts on the debate as it's just emerged this week. The Pentagon has released satellite images of the complex that was taken after the UN inspectors left days before your unit arrived. They're claiming that it was then under Saddam Hussein's control and that there were trucks parked there and that these explosives could have been removed before U.S. soldiers came. that, again, the thought is that they were removed before the unit that you were with came.
Well, you know, it's not for me to speculate, but I will tell you, as a reporter working responsibly as an embedded reporter, we can both tell you we were there. We were there 9 days after Baghdad fell. The place was not guarded, and there were bunker after bunker after bunker loaded with explosives. The only question really now is whether these were precisely the explosives that everyone's talking about. And even now there's evidence, the seals on these bunkers being one, and other experts looking at some of the videotape and saying, yeah, that's exactly how this stuff would have been stored and labeled. Mm.
Your thoughts on former Mayor Rudy Giuliani's comments yesterday that if these explosives were looted, well, it was the soldiers' responsibility.
I can honestly say that these soldiers were given orders. At the time we were there, April 18th, this was a LIFT battalion that was flying missions in and around Baghdad. They weren't asked to guard these facilities at that time. It wasn't that what their job was. I think it's unfair to point the finger on the soldier on the ground over there. These guys are doing everything that they're asked, and that was a little out of place in my mind.
Joe, when did you realize you had something on tape that was being debated on the campaign trail?
You know what? We knew that we had something significant at the time, and we filed a story back in April of 2003 for that night's news. But then the tape sat in our shelf basically for the last 18 months. It was last Sunday that Dean called me and said, Joe, I think we've got something here. We better pull the tape. And we did pull the tape and realized that we turned out to be the only television crew in the world, I guess, that got inside these bunkers.
Joe Caffrey is a photographer for KSTP Television in Minneapolis. He and reporter Dean Staley shot the video of explosives in Iraq last April. Dean now reports for Northwest Cable News in Washington State. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, candidate John Kerry has seized on the issue of the missing explosives to lash out at President Bush for a lack of planning in the war in Iraq. Meantime, the president is calling Senator Kerry the wrong man for the wrong job at the wrong time. The president is campaigning in Manchester, New Hampshire today. Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling was supposed to be with him but backed out. Bruce Springsteen was with Kerry yesterday in Wisconsin and inspired thousands of fans to walk six blocks to a polling station and cast an early vote. Well, for a roundup of events on the campaign trail and a look ahead, we're joined by editors from two battleground states, Guy McMillan of the Keene Sentinel in New Hampshire. Hi, Guy.
Hi, Robin.
We're also joined by Brad Rogers of the Ocala Star-Banner in Central Florida. Brad, did I say that right?
Ocala, yes.
Oh, boy. Okay. Brad, welcome to you as well. And Guy, I want to start with you. Just heard news of these missing explosives. Is this having an impact on voters, or is it too much information and too late?
Well, you know, I still have not found in the last month an undecided voter to ask that question to. It seems to me that the voters who are planning to vote for George Bush on Tuesday think that the timing of this story is suspicious, and those who are planning to vote for John Kerry believe that it confirms their feelings that the administration has been rash and incompetent in its war on Iraq. So does it change things? Maybe in the margins, right. But I haven't yet found the person that will admit to that.
It seems to be hardening positions. Well, Brad, in Florida, your state has already started to vote. This early voting phenomenon, in 2000, 13 states offered early voting. Now there are 23. It could be a fifth of the ballots cast before Election Day. So I know this is a first for Florida. How's it going there?
It's busy. Long lines. Candidates have already figured out that that's the place to be. Right now, I believe we've already had about 15 to 18% of our voters go to the polls. And, I mean, they're waiting in line.
Yeah, and what's happening there? I mean, are they as well guarded, so to speak, as the traditional voting on Election Day? What's happening?
They're doing it at the election office. In our community, they're doing it at the elections office. And, they're guarded, but, I mean, they're not. They're lined up outside.
Are people campaigning?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the hue and cry we're hearing, is that they've got to do something about the law to keep candidates at bay, that a lot of people are calling it harassment. Mm-hmm. They can't just stand in line and wait to vote without a candidate approaching them.
So people are already at the polls in states like Florida, and we want to just touch on the issues that are driving them. You said, Guy, that you couldn't find an undecided voter. Our listeners are sick of hearing from undecided voters. How about somebody who's made up their mind? Here's Todd Erickson. He's a listener. He's a paralegal from Miami, Florida. He's backing Bush.
This wasn't a choice between George Bush and John Kerry. I would never vote for John Kerry. George Bush represents a moral fiber that I think is vital. I think people need to be responsible. People need to recognize that they don't get everything here and now, and that they need to get an education. They need to make sure their kids get an education. It's about building a solid foundation for the country so that 100 years from now, we're still here and we're still thriving.
Well, and now, you know, voters have made up their minds and so have newspapers. Brad, you're in Florida. That's one of your constituents, possibly. I mean, he's in Florida. How did your paper endorse and what's been the reaction?
We endorsed Bush, and it's been a strange reaction.
How so?
Well, we were one of only two newspapers in the state to endorse Bush. And, you know, we knew there was partisan division in the state and in the country, but we've actually had some negative response from Republicans who resented the so-called liberal press endorsing their candidate. So, you know, you can't win for losing, but...
Guy, I mean, I know your paper's endorsed John Kerry up in New Hampshire, correct?
That is right.
Well, endorsing is odd this year. I mean, Brad mentions that anecdote, but in addition to that, 36 papers that voted for or endorsed Bush in 2000 have shifted to John Kerry this year. Six papers went Republican that were for the Democrat in 2000. Have you noticed this oddness in endorsements?
I have not, although I must say that endorsements are a little bit like who you're going to vote for, only on the printed page. And I think there are more people that I know anyway who voted for Bush in 2000 who say they're now going to vote for Kerry than the other way around. That doesn't take into the mix the possibility that there'll be a lot of new voters.
So maybe the newspapers are just reflecting that.
I think the newspapers, to some extent, reflect the point of view in the community. I don't think any of us in deciding endorsements do it deliberately, but we are a product of our region and of the people that that we serve. Sure.
Yeah. And yet the polls show still a really tight race. Just briefly from you, Guy, what is happening in New Hampshire? It's a state that's more in contention now than it has been in the past.
This is right on the edge, and frankly, I can't answer exactly what is happening. I will say that in 2000, New Hampshire went for Bush by 7,000 votes, but there were 20,000 votes for Nader. So if you factor out those Nader votes, and many of them, I think, are going to go by the wayside this year, where are they going to go? And obviously, they've created a neck-and-neck race that nobody wants to predict in New Hampshire for our four electoral votes.
Yeah. Well, that's Guy McMillan from the Keene Sentinel up in New Hampshire. We also spoke to Brad Rogers of the Ocala Star-Banner in Central Florida. Brad, we're going to let you go because the election started for you. You have to go cover it. So thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Guy, you stay right there. When we come back, we're going to be joined by a reporter from Ohio. And we're also going to find out if it means anything that a Red Sox pitcher was supposed to campaign for President Bush up in New Hampshire today and didn't. And we're going to hear more voters who've made up their minds. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our scanning of the political landscape with Guy McMillan of the Keene Sentinel up in New Hampshire. And Guy, I'm looking at some of the other news today. The Commerce Department has the new economic numbers. It says they're lower than economists predicted. We know the FBI has launched an expanded investigation of Halliburton's no-bid contract in the Iraq War. Are any of these issues resonating? What are people in New Hampshire talking about?
Well, they're talking about the Red Sox still.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I can't imagine that a complex set of economic statistics or even this 360 tons of missing explosives would change somebody's vote at this late date. I think people have made up their minds, and it's possible, I suppose, that you could change people's minds with some dramatic development, but none of this strikes me as particularly dramatic.
Right. Well, and you touched on the Red Sox. Let's just touch on it again briefly. Ace pitcher Curt Schilling, who is a born-again from Texas and had a conversation with President Bush after he mentioned on ABC's Good Morning America that people should vote for Bush. He was supposed to go up to your area and campaign with George Bush. He said he's not going to now. And on a blog that is supposed to be his words, he was quoted as saying that, you know, maybe he shouldn't have been partisan at this time. How did people up there react? I mean, a moment like that could be a tipping point. How did people react to mixing politics with, you know, sports?
The only remarks that I've heard were from Democrats who said, why did he have to go and spoil it? But I'm sure there are a lot of Republicans that I haven't spoken with who would say, well, good for him. You know, look, there's a lot of entertainers in this race. You know, you've got Arnold out in Ohio today. Bruce Hornsby is coming on Sunday with Kerry here in New Hampshire. Of course, Springsteen's been all over the news. I'm not sure that these people do much more than attract TV camera crews, but they're in the race and they're part of it.
Right. Well, now you spoke about not finding a single person who was undecided up your way. Most people are making up their minds, and here's another woman who did, Yvette Mitchell from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and making that decision, she said, was keeping her up nights.
My son got up and came to my door and looked at me and said, "Mom, why are you awake?" And I said, "Because I can't decide who to vote for." And he looked at me and he said, "Mom, you don't have to worry about that. The answer, I know where it is." And I said, "Where?" And he put his hand over his heart. He said, "It's right here, in your heart." The issue that I was most concerned about could be addressed by John Kerry. I really appreciated the way he addressed education and what he was doing with regard to the minimum wage, addressing health care. And these are things that were very critical to me and the longevity of my family.
So, Guy McMillan, it seems as if the campaigns are also switching their attentions from campaigning on the issues, because people are making up their minds, to, you know, getting ready to decide the vote with the lawyers. I mean, to looking at how the elections are actually going to take place.
Well, yes, with the lawyers. We have actually lawyers who are going to be at the polling places here in Keene, New Hampshire, on Tuesday to make sure that there aren't any dirty tricks, and I expect this is going to happen all over the country. I'm hoping, because I, like that lady, will put my hand over my heart and hope that elections will not be so seriously disputed that we'll never decide who won. But it does look as it's going to be contested pretty vigorously.
Well, in fact, we've got with us now Bill Cohen of the Statehouse News Bureau in Columbus, Ohio. Bill, we were talking about the provisional ballots in your state. There's already been a lot of legal maneuvering. And we heard from someone that the election might not be decided in this pivotal state for weeks after the voting because of those provisional ballots. How's that going?
Well, that's true, because there's been a lot of controversy. We've got several court suits going here. The last ruling, though, favored Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell and his ruling. He basically said you must vote in the right precinct. If you want to be if you go to the wrong polling place and demand a provisional ballot, well, we'll hand you one. But if we find out later that you were in the wrong polling place, your vote will not count. So both sides basically are telling their base, hey, you better make sure you are in the right polling place on Election Day. But that's not the only controversy we have here that's been in the courts and so forth. Today, a federal appeals court gave its stamp of approval to a federal judge's ruling earlier this week, a ruling that put on hold hearings by county boards of elections into possible voter registration fraud. What happened was 35,000 cards that had been mailed to thousands of newly registered voters came back, basically labeled return to sender. And so Republicans had charged those registrations may have been fraudulent.
Right.
And so some county election boards started calling in hundreds of newly registered people to prove they did indeed exist and prove they'd indeed registered properly. But Democrats convinced the federal courts to block those hearings. And at the moment at least, those hearings remain on hold. So it's a victory for the Democrats, a loss for the Republicans.
So now all the hearings are on hold, because we understood yesterday it was just six counties.
Well, at the moment, I believe it's just six counties that are on hold. But now there are some hearings today to determine whether or not that ruling should spread to all the counties. And meanwhile, there's still another battlefront, because some Democrats up in Akron have filed a court suit charging that Republican monitors at the polling places on Election Day will wind up intimidating minorities and low-income people from voting. And at least that one suit actually wants the law that allows the monitors from both parties to be declared unconstitutional. And there's kind of an irony there. That's a 51-year-old law, and Democrats themselves plan to take advantage of it, to have monitors at the polls on Election Day. But here we have some Democrats trying to have the whole law thrown out.
Yeah, well, that's Bill Cohen in Ohio, and we just have under a minute left. Guy up in New Hampshire, you know, there's going to be monitors there as well. They're going to be crawling across the country, lawyers and monitors. How are people in New Hampshire, very private about their vote, how are people going to respond to people hovering over them when they vote?
I think we're getting a little less private. I think there's going to be a rush to the polls on Tuesday. We normally run an editorial on Monday urging people to get out and vote. This year we're going to urge them not to knock their neighbors over on their rush to the polls. This is going to be a record breaker, I think. This is a very active group of people up here, a lot of lawn signs, a lot of activity.
Well, Guy McMillan of the Keene Sentinel in New Hampshire, thanks so much for giving us a snapshot of New Hampshire just a few days before the election. Bill Cohen of the State House News Bureau in Columbus, Ohio, thank you as well. And off they go. And you stay there. We'll be right back. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Investigative reporter Seymour Hirsch joins us now. He was one of the first to report the abuses at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. He spent the last 3 years covering the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and he's just published a book. It's called Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. He joins us in the studio. Hi, Seymour.
Hello.
Now, your book reprises the reporting for The New York you've been doing since 9/11 with new revelations we want to hear about. But what's your overarching message when you graph it out?
Oh, goodbye, George Bush.
Goodbye, or it should be goodbye? I mean, is this...
Well, if he's reelected, here's what he's going to do. He's going to bomb and bomb and bomb because he's absolutely as much as virtuous as I feel writing an alternative history, more or less, in The New Yorker for the last 3 years. I really think I have the white hat. I'm the good guy. He feels the same way about what he's doing. He's absolutely convinced that we've got to bring democracy and whatever the cost. And if he's reelected, he's going to do the only thing he can do, try to prop up this puppet government of Alawi, who is a government that has no standing. He's going to try and prop it up, and the only way he can do it is by bombing. And what's happened in the last 3 months since Alawi became prime minister, which is not being remarked about, even in this debate, even in the current political era, the bombing has gone up exponentially. American bombing of Iraq is almost, and sometimes it's almost continuous. We are bombing and bombing. We don't know how many sorties. We don't know how much tonnage. We don't know the difference week to week. It's going up and up. We're now at war with the country.
A new report has just come out. Research shows that over 100,000 Iraqis have been killed by the bombing that you mentioned.
Yes. The number I was playing with always was 50,000, but that the study in the British journal, The Lancet, yes, it's certainly, look, and each of those people that die is another reason why we're never going to win the war. The war is gone. You know, name me an occupier that uses violence that's won a war. It doesn't happen.
Well, let me ask you something, because I want to move on to some of the points you make in the new book that are new, at least to me. What do you say to those? You say you're wearing the white hat. What do you say to those who say you're just as ideologically driven and you're unable to see clearly because of that?
Well, one of the things that happened is once the war began, I began talking. What happened with Bush is simple. He said, you're either for us or against us. And the way it broke out is in early 2002 when Bush decided to go to Iraq. On the inside, those people on the inside who supported the idea that the way to fight international terrorism is to go to Baghdad and take on Saddam, those who believe that was the right thing to do were geniuses. Those inside, three-star generals, senior CIA guys, State Department officers who give the best intelligence and best advice throughout their career to their leadership, those guys who said this is wacky were exercised. They weren't allowed to sit at the table. They were simply cut out of the process. It wasn't loyal dissent. It was being a traitor.
But give me some make a comparison for me. Some would say that's always that's always the setup. It's the military against the, you know, the diplomacy. There's always friction. This is what
in this case, the people who objected, who had arguments against going to Iraq, were not allowed to sit at the table, were not allowed to give their views. This is a presidency that doesn't listen, that doesn't hear what he doesn't want to hear.
Well, speaking of which, you say that Vice President Dick Cheney called Donald Rumsfeld with a very simple message when news of Abu Ghraib started to float around. What was that message?
Well, he said, no resignations. We're all going to hang tight on this one. This was in May after the stories I wrote. CBS also put out some photographs of the horror of Abu Ghraib. You know, the pictures, we all remember that. You know, we don't have to get into that.
Right.
It was a big crisis, a lot of dissent. And so Rumsfeld's message was fascinating on two counts. One, as I write in the book, it was a political message because obviously we were coming into an election year. And what I didn't say in the book, and I thought about later, was this. Here comes this horrible scandal. The White House claims it has no information about abuses of prisoners. Is Cheney, the vice president, is saying to Don Rumsfeld, hey, Don, what's going on over there? What kind of nuttiness is that? I want a full investigation. I want to know. I want a complete report. I want it on my table tomorrow morning. We can't have this kind of a stuff because it kills us in the Arab world. We're trying to make peace. We're trying to stop terrorism. Does he say that? No. And one of the reasons I then extrapolate, basically what I'm saying in this book and I'm saying everywhere I can now, is that the responsibility for the mistreatment of prisoners began very early. It began as soon as the war began.
And who's telling you this, by the way?
Oh, I'm not inventing this. I talked to people, the same people, the three stars and the senior guys who can't get their views to the president, who care as much about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as I do. They then go outside.
You say a Republican operative told you about the exchange between Cheney and Rumsfeld. He was consoled by the exchange.
No.
You explain.
Well, the point is that everybody was very concerned that the vice, there's no moral leadership in this White House, and most of the conservative Republicans have a strong moral basis. You know, they believe as much as anybody else. They have a point of view, and it's a balanced budget and all that. Many of the conservatives, the true conservatives in this country, are very turned off by the Bush administration, not only because of this sort of unending war that was stupidly got into, but also because of the financial policies and the huge debt. There's no money in the government.
I want to ask you about another little reported battle, the Battle of Anaconda. This is in Afghanistan. Just could you briefly...
I love you asking that question because Tommy Franks, the general, has been all over, you know, basically pimping along for President Bush at various rallies. And Franks, this is an account of one of the stupidest... what happened is the army decided they were going to go after the Al-Qaeda. Up a mountain pass in Tora Bora. The mountain is the area between Pakistan and Afghanistan that's very difficult, where Osama bin Laden may be, may not be. In any case, before the battle began, the Marine Corps, and you got to love the Marines because they'll fight to the last minute, but they also say what they think. They were against going to Iraq without a big force. And in this case, they said, you want us to go up a mountain pass where we with Afghans, where we don't know what's on top and who's there with no intelligence, we're not going. And they refused to go. This is one of the few stories when I was at the New Yorker early on I did not write because it was too terrifying. It was too disturbing for me. I thought it would be too counterproductive. The Marines refused to go on a mission. The Army troops that went in were blown away. We suffered. We walked into a terrible ambush. One unit of the 10th Mountain Brigade out of Fort Drum, New York, suffered something like 40 or 50%, more than 55 or 60% casualties, all wounded. In 5 minutes, they landed. They jumped from a chopper. The bad guys, the Al-Qaeda, knew where they were, knew in advance what was going on because the Afghans that we relied on tipped them off. It was a disaster. And I chickened out on it. It's one of the, you know, as I say in the book, I should have done it, but I did not.
And why didn't you?
I just thought at the time that writing that the Marine Corps had refused to go on a mission, had absolutely said to Franks and the other generals, you guys don't know what you're doing, to the point where, as I write, the Marine Corps actually signed an MOU, a written memorandum of understanding between them and General Franks in the CENTCOM command in Tampa. They had a formal agreement about how they were going to be used. things were that bad. There was so much contempt for some of the things Franks was doing. And I just thought early in a war, to be honest, I'll tell you, it was a selfish thought. I thought the Marines who were talking to me and other people would be so burned by this story that I might lose sources and I was better off holding back.
Yeah. For I'm sure, one of the few times that you've done that.
Well, you know, look, we all do things. I'll just finish it. I had talked to Wes Clark about it earlier, and he'd encouraged me to do it. When I ran into him when Clark was running for president, the former NATO general, he jumped on my bones. He said, you should have written it. It's your obligation as a reporter. He's right.
Well, he's written it now. It's always, as usual, provocative because it's from Seymour Hersh. Investigative reporter Seymour Hersh's new book is called Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. I'm sure you're going to provoke thought and response, and we'll be listening for it. Seymour, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. We recently had a chance to take to the stage at Boston's Huntington Theater to speak with actress Felicia Rashad, star of August Wilson's new play, Gem of the Ocean.
They're going through all their light cues, right?
Right.
That's the way they do it now. They used to actually just have a light that was that color and turn it on and off, but now, through modern technology, they figured out how to put the gels on rolls, and we get to listen to this all through the show.
It's kind of like a rock concert.
Gem of the Ocean is the ninth in Wilson's 10-play cycle about African-American life. The title refers to the bones of slaves who died on the forced crossing to America. And Rashad takes on the role of Aunt Esther, a 285-year-old spiritual link between the living and the dead, guiding the living to salvation in the Hill District of Pittsburgh in 1904.
In addition to the seriousness of her role, how fun to be 285 years old every night and not care what anybody thinks about what you say. And
it's a lot of fun.
Woo!
It is a juicy role. Aunt Esther is mentioned in all of Wilson's plays, but this is the first time she's seen on stage. When the lighting check was finished, we sat down at the wooden kitchen table on the beautifully textured set.
We're in Aunt Esther's house, and that is a cast iron stove. It is authentic.
I hope you don't take offense because I'm heading towards a compliment, but I came in a couple minutes late, and I settled down, and I looked out on the stage. I said, oh, gosh, I can't wait till Felicia Rashad comes out. That's her. It took me a few minutes to see you in your character.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. You just become that person. You assume that person through belief first.
Let's explain. Who is Aunt Esther?
Aunt Esther is the wise woman. She is a wise woman in that she carries the memories of the people, thousands and thousands and thousands of people, for hundreds of years, who came across the Middle Passage.
Where did you find Aunt Esther? You are a Tony Award-winning actress. You are not acting old, you know, on the stage. So how do you organically find her?
I find her in the writing. Yes, it's all there. It's through the rhythm of her speech. Let's see, give you an example. The people will come and tell you anything. They'll tell you this, they'll tell you that. They got all kinds of problems. But you soon come to find out, most of the time they're looking for love. Love go a long way towards making you right with yourself. They're looking for love, don't know what it is. You tell them, they still don't know. You got to show them how to find it for themselves.
Some of the physicality, she has a tremor in her hand. There's something about her step. Anyone you knew, or again, just from the script?
This happened very organically. And this movement in her hand has to do more with, it's energetic. It's not a malady. It is energetic.
Because she's got a lot to do, including saving Citizen Barlow, who's a young man who escaped the Jim Crow South and accidentally leads to another man's death. What does she do for him?
She does for him what she does for everybody. She helps him to remember the truth about himself.
My name is Esther Dyer. Some people call me Aunt Esther. What do they call you?
Citizen. They call me Citizen Barlow.
Was you looking for money, Mr. Citizen? I'd give you $2 if I had my purse. Well, you can go in that room there and bring me my purse, and I'll give you $2. In that room there on the next day, you can go get it, and I'll give you $2.
I ain't looking for no money. I ain't no robber. I come to see you.
This is the ninth in the 10-play August Wilson cycle. How important, what does that mean to you to be a part of that work?
This is the answer to prayers. This is dream come true. Yes. Yes. Because you see, for so long, much to my chagrin, I came to understand that I was being viewed as a television actress and not an actress. I didn't know there was a difference.
And not just a television actress, but one of the most successful and recognized in one of the most successful television shows ever.
Yeah. Mr. Cosby has always considered me an actress.
So it must be sweet not just to have that vindication, but to have it in this work. What do you say, if anything, to August Wilson about Aunt Esther?
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Felicia Rashad, thank you.
Thank you.
Felicia is starring in August Wilson's Gem of the Ocean, on its way to Broadway, now at the Huntington Theater in Boston. Stay there. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In today's cluttered media environment, it's hard to imagine, but back in 1924, there was one distinct voice, and this new thing called radio provided the soundtrack for the jazz age. ...1924 was the year of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, Bootleg Liquor, and Red Hot Flappers, but the year also marked a new era in political campaigning. Radio became the new bullhorn for politicians, and the first to use it with great effect was Calvin Coolidge. As the incumbent president, Coolidge surrounded himself with his buddies from Amherst College, successful Madison Avenue advertising men, who helped shape his image and advised Coolidge on how best to utilize broadcast radio. A new exhibit called 1924, The Radio Election, Presidential Campaigning in the Coolidge Era, is on display at the historic Northampton Museum in Northampton, Massachusetts. Kerry Buckley is the museum's director, and he recently spoke with Here and Now producer April Peavy.
Well, 1924 is an important election year for two reasons. One, it's the first election in which radio as a national medium was really of any significance in a presidential campaign. And secondly, radio was part of a media strategy that was developed around Coolidge's candidacy, and it marks a real shift in the way American politics was conceived and executed, a real change in the party structure where big money and big advertising and national media really combined to create a marketing structure for political candidates.
I want to get to some of the players involved in the 1924 radio election. Obviously, the first big name is Calvin Coolidge himself. Tell me a little bit about his style. What did he sound like?
He had a kind of an oratorical style that was repetitive, but he was very effective on radio, first of all, because he was the first president to use it, and second of all, with the primitive radio equipment and reception, he had a high-pitched twang that you could hear above the static. So that was quite effective. Now, whether he would be an effective speaker later on when amplified sound came in is questionable. But in 1924, he was on the cutting edge.
The first duty of a government is to be true to itself. This does not mean perfection. It means a plan to strive for perfection. It means loyalty to ideals. The ideals of America were set out in the Declaration of Independence.
Another big player was behind the scenes, a gentleman by the name of Bruce Barton.
Oh, absolutely. He was a real groundbreaker and pioneer in advertising. And he advised Coolidge, look, you know, radio is different. Your audience can walk away from you without your knowing it, but it provides an opportunity to have a conversation with your audience. Speak to them as if you're sitting, he said, by their fireside. Something FDR would exploit masterfully a couple of years later. But he speak to them in a conversational tone and you'll elect yourself.
I believe in the American Constitution. I favor the American system of individual enterprise, and I am opposed to any general extension of government ownership and control.
What Barton found in 1924 is that Coolidge had a limited repertoire, and scandal really hung over the Republican Party. And the 20s was a dark time. I mean, underneath the glitz of the Jazz Age, you had the domestic terrorist. You had the Ku Klux Klan marching down Pennsylvania Avenue in broad daylight. Farmers in the South and the Midwest were already losing their farms. The Depression had begun its downward slide by 1924. So the economy, scandal, domestic terrorism, if it sounds familiar, one can make the parallels. But what Barton said, I mean, literally, you can read it in his transcripts and his letters, we have nothing to sell this year but Calvin Coolidge. So what he developed was what we would call today a campaign of personality. It was character. It was the farmer. It was a man from Vermont, integrity and so forth. It was what you heard over the radio was what came across was the personality, the intimacy.
In Abraham Lincoln is revealed our ideal, the hope of our country fulfilled. He was the incarnation of what America was to be.
And, I mean, Coolidge is one of the first presidents to use the image as part of the ceremonial role of the president. I mean, we have these photographs of him wearing cowboy hats and chaps and Indian headdresses and this sort of thing. And, you know, we laugh and we smile, but I think Coolidge and Barton understood that, you know, in darkened movie theaters across the country, you know, the image of the president, I mean, if it made people laugh or even feel superior, it was worth 100 stump speeches, you know, getting his image out.
I guess the way to explain it, looking at today's election, is that he really, in many ways, was the Karl Rove. Mm. What Karl Rove is to President Bush, mm-hmm. Bruce Barton was to Calvin Coolidge.
Right, and it really all began very, very early on, as early as 1919, right after the Boston police strike, when Coolidge's name just began to surface nationally. Coolidge's Amherst alum brought in Bruce Barton, who was another Amherst alum, to hone and Coolidge, polish him up for the presidential run in 1920. Of course, they engineered his vice presidential nomination. So he stayed part of that team. Part of that team, big money and big advertising to create an image that we now associate with Calvin Coolidge, sort of building on some of his negative qualities and turning them into positive qualities. So you're right. I mean, Barton essentially was the Karl Rove. He understood and actually used things that we take for granted in politics today, the photo op and the pseudo event.
It really was the election of not only radio, but of photo ops, mm-hmm. of magazine articles, advertisements, mm-hmm. bumper stickers, mm-hmm. all of that really just kind of came to fruition in 1924.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, that we look back in our historical imaginations, you know, when we look back before the 1920s, we see the 19th century and the clothing and the attitudes. The 1920s is when, you know, the modernist America really came of age. All the institutions that we recognize today really not only began but flowered in their full form in the 1920s. It was the time when you really had the breakout of national brands, national mass media publications. And radio was a time, and motion pictures was a time when regional differences really began to break down. Language and accent, customs and habits, you know, really you begin to have a homogenized America, and many of these things reflect that.
So keep cool and keep Coolidge is the slogan of the day. Keep cool and keep Coolidge for the good old USA.
Kerry Buckley, director of the historic Northampton Museum and Education Center in Western Massachusetts. For more information on their exhibit on the 1924 radio election, check out our website, here-now.org. Our piece was produced by Here and Now's April Peavy.
The chance to do it in this year of 24. He's been tried, he's never wanting. He is giving of his best. So keep cool and keep cool it in our country's mighty test with a private
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio, have a great weekend, and join us again. Here and Now.
With a countenance serene, defender of the righteous, and a juggernaut to wrong, we'll make him stay in Washington 100 million strong. So keep cool and keep Coolidge is the slogan of the day. Keep cool and keep Coolidge for the good old U.S.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.